what a state we find ourselves in. The rand weakened against the dollar after the Reserve Bank kept its benchmark rate at a record low yesterday, while the JSE closed firmer amid mixed global markets. The bank's Monetary Policy Committee maintained the repo rate at 3.5%, in line with the median forecast of 18 analysts surveyed by Bloomberg. But it looks like the next move is going to be up. So start paying off those credit cards. Pick n Pay Group Chief Executive Peter Boone has called for President Cyril Ramaphosa to lift the country's restrictions on the sale of alcohol. Boone said that the easing of restrictions is going to be especially beneficial to those businesses that have been so severely impacted by the recent looting and the unrest in parts of the country. And as the vaccination drive got into high gear with the Generation X's this week, I just wish we could go out as much as our electricity does. To put things into perspective, I'm joined by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Isa Mplanga, Chief Economist at Alexander Forbes. Warwick, markets sort of waxed and waned this week on every new Delta variant headline, it seemed. Surely markets will start looking beyond the pandemic as we start to see global vaccination rates approaching herd immunity in key developed markets.
Michael, I think it's going to be a process of attrition getting there. I think I almost feel a sort of a sense of Groundhog Day, just as we had in the middle of the Trump presidency, when every day there'd be some new shot fired in the trade war with China, and it would be this and it would be that, and the market would be up and would down in process. But overall, a trend got followed, and I think the trend relating to COVID is that central banks have created masses of liquidity and are very accommodative of both markets and economies. The same could be said of fiscal policy. And I think we're sort of going to be traveling in those kind of tram lines for quite some time, that although we could look at the environment and say to ourselves, gosh, I really am struggling to feel bullish, yet all the environment is set up in order to try and underpin markets so that they don't become an added source of risk. So that I think is the state of play.
Isa, if you look at it though, we're in the midst of US earnings season, and so far we've had 80-odd% or even higher beating on already lofty expectations for earnings. Overnight we had had Twitter and a few other tech shares outperforming it and bouncing after the market closed. So at a fundamental level, it looks like companies are growing, the earnings are there. Why the skittishness still in global markets about the future trajectory of economic growth?
I think if we just look at the current earnings, they reflect what businesses have been doing over the last 12 months. We are now in a space where we are reaching an inflection point with what I would characterize as four peaks. It's peak economic policy support, which means the best of economic policy support from monetary policy and fiscal policy is now behind us. And the implication for that is we also have a peak commodity price performance, which means the best of commodity price performance is now also behind us, which implies that we have also seen peak economic growth now behind us. So the implications moving forward is that peak earnings is what we see now, and very quickly it will now be behind us. So going forward, we're likely to see a moderation in earnings and in the performance of growth assets over the next 12 months. And by the way, we are not expecting the next 12 months to deliver the sort of returns that we saw over the last 12 months. So the best is behind us. Where we are going, we're likely to see a moderation. If you combine that with monetary policy from the US Fed that is likely to normalize, then we see a more moderate 12 months coming.
To build on that theme of the best being behind us, Raymond, if you look at the tone of the MPC statement yesterday, it seemed a lot more dovish than the previous statement. The decision to hold was unanimous, but there was still the quarterly projection model showing that we could be in for 5 25 bip increases if we were to follow that model. Is it fair to say that the best in terms of these record low, multi-decade low interest rates are behind us in the South African context?
Hi, Michael. Look, I like the statement. I thought it was very balanced. And as you said, it was quite dovish because I think it took on board some of the more important developments and shocks which we've experienced in the past few weeks. So I thought also that you would have noticed that in the statement that the quarterly, you know, projection model was relegated almost to the last paragraph, which is where it belongs for the moment, I think. Mm. We need to use our judgment, and I think that is where the Reserve Bank yesterday showed it had more antenna about the events of the past few weeks. I would just isolate or identify three important aspects that I took away. Firstly, I think too many commentators have focused on what the bank said about headline inflation. In fact, it was qualified to say core inflation is coming down, and we are comfortable with that for the moment. And I think that's a very important distinction to make. The second is, it may have been surprising in a way that the bank decided to leave its forecast for our GDP this year at 4.2%. But you know, although there are other forecasts, they are very preliminary. We're still in a phase of uncertainty as to what the net impact will be on our economy. So I don't really blame the bank for deciding that a week after those serious events that we've experienced, that it will stick with its forecast for the time being. And in 2 months' time, it can update it and see what it's going to do. And then finally, I thought what was important, compared with what some of our commentators have been saying, it did say, look, that our economic and our business confidence and our investor confidence has been damaged. It has been damaged, and we need to take note of that. And we'll see whether it shows up in the capital formation figures later. But what's important, I think, that must come out of that recognition is it's not that we've had civil unrest. Other countries have civil unrest. We've had civil unrest. It's how you seem to be dealing with it, whether the way you deal with it inspires confidence that it's unlikely to happen again, because you'll be putting in place the remedies and the reforms you need in order to stabilize the long-term situation. So I think that is quite important, and those are some of the key takeaways that I had from the broad message which the governor had for South Africa yesterday.
I want to come back to that issue of confidence. And Warwick, confidence is so important for local businesses, for SMEs, for small businesses. And we've been focusing on the president's drive to drum up international foreign inward bound investment. But if you're not going to get local businesses to invest and be excited about the investment opportunity in this economy, then foreigners are certainly not going to get excited about it. So we need to get local businesses confident enough to invest. Surely confidence has been absolutely decimated in the face of a state that seemed to fail to be able to protect assets on the ground. What can be done to repair this very fragile and damaged confidence from here?
Well, I mean, Michael, it's I think a real problem, of course, in relation to the likes of metros. I mean, they're obviously in a state of disarray, and they do need a complete overhaul. I mean, after all, I think the big problem and the big risk following on from the Zuma administration was that corruption and other generally dishonest governance started to become a way of life. And once it becomes endemic, it can be exceptionally difficult to root out. So, I mean, your ongoing focus needs to be to make sure that you continue to sweep out the stables in many forms, and that takes a number of processes. I mean, first of all, there's the case that dishonest conduct needs to be punished and prevented, and of course competence needs to be hired in and rewarded, and that's obviously an extensive process. I mean, it sounds like a simple way to do things, but remember, when that hasn't been occurring in your target institution for quite some time, it's actually quite revolutionary. So that is really the revolution that needs to happen in the next 3 to 4 years. And I mean, if we don't see it start happening, I don't know that you'd see it coming through in the municipal election so much, but definitely the national elections may very well be substantially about local delivery.
And last week, Friday, we saw five metros, Isa, placed deeper into junk by Moody's. I think it is at local government, really, where the president needs to be focusing a great deal of attention to help restore business confidence. You chat to a property owner and they say it's that interface with local government, administered prices in rates and taxes and water and sewage and all of that, well in excess of inflation over the last decade. But these are not quick fixes. What can be done in the very short term to help damage fragile investor confidence? Let's start by at least agreeing that we shouldn't be sending Transport Minister Fikile Mbalula to speak to Stephen Sacker on BBC's Hard Talk. Whoever made that decision needs to be fired.
Michael, I think quick fixes are no longer available to us as an option to solve many of our problems. What is required is really to be honest in terms of our assessment. So first, to deal with what we just saw over the last 2 weeks, to say what is the response of the law enforcement. The president need to be, you know, very robust in saying they need to be held accountable, so that we re-establish the safety of investors' funds and property at a local level. But beyond that, we have to really put in place mechanisms to generate jobs. No quick fixes, no transfers that are going to solve our long-held problems that we have been seeing with. And these things are not new, but for a very long time, we've held on to, you know, low-lying fruits. I would venture to say those low-hanging fruits have fallen off, they have rotten. What we need is to plant new trees that will bring more fruits over the long term, and those fruits will become jobs for people.
Absolutely. Thinking about the long term, Raymond, yes.
I think what's important here overall is we mustn't be too obsessed with foreign investor confidence, because that depends on domestic investor confidence.
That was my point.
You can't expect foreigners to have more confidence in South Africa than we have. So we've got to now use this crisis to create a new environment which will boost our domestic investor confidence and business confidence in the first place, introduce some short-term measures which are necessary from a social support point of view to deal with the poverty and the hunger that's been exposed. But nonetheless, the longer-term answer is, as the World Bank pointed out, you need to get this economy, and once you can get it moving and you build domestic confidence, it will be easier to mobilize foreign investor confidence. So I think that's the secret. We must get the sequence right.
Right.
That's very important.
That's what
get
I said earlier.
Get the sequence right so that we boost domestic investor confidence.
Absolutely.
So that we ensure that the steps, as I said earlier, we take will prevent a recurrence of what has happened recently.
A Business Day leader story this week foghorned that the political mood should rule out talk of lower inflation targets. Now, out of the review of the Saab centenary last month, it does appear that serious consideration is being given by the Saab, not immediately perhaps, but over the longer term, to reducing the inflation range of 3 to 6% to perhaps 3 to 5%, or to a single average figure of 4.5%, where it currently likes to anchor things. Reference has been made to similar steps by a couple of other central banks, the likes of India, that have recently trimmed their target range. The Saab has, in any event, in recent times wanted to anchor inflation. So what is involved here? What are the trade-offs? So Raymond, perhaps you could just kick us off, because this will improve our long-run competitiveness.
Hi, Michael. Look, I think, let me say immediately that I noted that the Business Day leader spoke about the political mood is against it. It's not the political mood, it's the economic mood that's against it. And we must see it through those spectacles and not try to, indeed, try to politicize it. I would just like to read, if I may, very quickly, a quote from a recent London Economist on this issue, where it says, and I read, "Yet though some central banks are raising interest rates, the situation is not acute. Both Russia and South Africa have recently floated the idea of tightening their inflation targets, which are currently 4% and 3 to 6% respectively. That would be absurd amid the rampant upward pressure in prices at the moment. I wouldn't use strong language like that, but all I'm saying is we need to understand that in this debate, our central bank does not have goal independence. It has operational independence. The goal is set by the cabinet. So quite clearly, there will have to be a discussion in the cabinet as to whether they would like to reduce it and even to perhaps bring it to a single figure. In other words, do we use the shotgun or do we use the rifle? And are we going to outsource our monetary policy to a single target? That's quite an important point. So I think what's important here is that there needs to be a process of discussion. I don't think it's the most important issue for South Africa at the moment. I intend to say, if it isn't broken, don't fix it. It has served us quite well. I think it's been a useful and flexible way of approaching it. So I think what's important here is that there should be an inclusive discussion, that it would have to go to the social partners in NEDLAC. I recall being involved when it was originally introduced, and there were views both from organized labor and from organized business. So there's a process to go through, and I think perhaps there are other more important, I would tend to think it's a more, there are more important issues for us now to be concerned about than to worry about wanting to tinker with the inflation targeting regime. But if there is to be a debate, it needs to be inclusive, and it will have to be the outcome of a broad debate, both within government and in the private sector.
And Isa, I just want to actually shift on from this, because I do think there are far more important issues surfacing in the country at the moment than where we anchor inflation. Because even if we did go from 3 to 6 to 4.5, the Reserve Bank likes to talk about 4.5 so often that it's in effect anchored around that point in any event. The calls now for a basic income grant in the wake of what we saw last week, it's a knee jerk, it's a reflexive response to say, right, we're government and we're here to help and we're hearing you. Your column in Business Day today likens it to a bandage on a broken bone. What do you make of this idea of a basic income grant given our fiscal circumstances?
You know, Michael, that call for a basic income grant that is universal should be resisted for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's a permanent spending that is going to be introduced that does not increase the productivity of the economy. So it does not have a new revenue stream that is going to fund it. Secondly, if we just look at the current fiscus, we simply don't afford it. And if you were to go back over the last 10 years, how our debt increased quite significantly until it is now unsustainable. It was because we cut spending on very important social spending items such as health, police, and education, only to fund a spending that did not return a positive return on equity, which is SOE. So half of what we cut in terms of spending went to show up SOEs. Similar thing with the basic income grant. If we are going to cut spending to finance a basic income grant that does not increase productivity over the long term, that will move us closer to an actual default, because ultimately there has to be a growth impact. Even if we were to tax the higher income earners, there's going to be an impact in terms of consumption, which will slow down economic growth and taxes ultimately, which will mean the state would have to go and borrow new funds to fund a basic income grant. So it is a wrong kind of thing to do, because it does not solve the fundamental problems of unemployment. We need to be, putting together a set of policies that improves the productivity, that improves the investment environment for new investors to come and invest and create jobs. Yes, we do recognize in terms of the impact of COVID, but also in terms of the impact of the recent events in terms of looting and vandalization of warehouses and businesses, in terms of people's jobs. That requires a short-term solution to try and help. But we can't use that as a means to introduce a permanent spending without identifying a permanent source of revenue.
I think it's an important distinction to make here, Warwick, the difference between what is a temporary support measure if you as government are going to be shutting down particular sectors like alcohol and the restaurant industry and supporting them through the lockdown versus introducing a permanent basic income grant. And it boils down to what Anthony Butler referred to in his column today, to a decision to whether or not you want to be a developmental state or a welfare state or a capable state. We just really seem to be heading down the road of failed state at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think Isaiah's put his finger on the important point there, is that the danger is that you create it in such a way that it can wind up getting embedded permanently. And that's certainly not a solution. I mean, the big part of the problem is that with assorted minimum wages and generally difficult labor infrastructure, combine that with a lack of responsive and responsible government, and you have created the perfect environment for a citizenry that is utterly dependent on the state and basically doesn't function for itself. And so I would have said that, well, by the same token, of course, we have an environment in which people who are out of jobs, suffering from lockdown and so on, literally do fear starving to death in the short term. So how do you deal with that? You deal with that with short-term measures, i.e. making sure that is actually dealt with. But if we look at the riots, I mean, it's not as if these were just about starving people. I mean, there was the number one item taken away, for example, was refrigerators, and the shocking scenes of cars lined up along the N3 waiting to cart away stolen goods. Well, not a sight related to starving. That is exploitation of the wealthy crooked, of the weak crooked. The wealthy crooked of the poor. So we obviously need to deal with the temporary situation, but putting in some kind of permanent situation like a BIG, I mean, that's questionable. I mean, on my quick numbers here, if they talk about 350 Rand per month, times the adult population of South Africa, 36.5 million, we're talking about a line item of 153 billion Rand per year. The reality is you cannot create dependency on this scale. I mean, much as we'd like to, people will need to use every bit of their wits to create their own living. Otherwise, I mean, it's just too much for the state. The state, we have seen before, is unable to support that. I mean, what is our tax take? It's in the order of about a trillion rand a year. Now you're talking about a budget that would be bigger than education or health, I would say.
And that is the bottom line here around how we can reprioritize spending towards this without seriously damaging spending on education and health. Raymond, just your final thoughts on a basic income grant in an environment where we are seeing hunger in specific areas like KZN reaching a point where people really do face the threat of starvation.
Michael, if I could build on what has been said so far in a nutshell, what we want to do, whatever we do in the short term, and there are certain urgent things we need to do in the short term, but the fact remains, what we really want to do in the longer term, and this flows from what we've said earlier, we want to move more people out of welfare into work. I mean, that we want to lessen the dependence which a large part of the population have and get them into a framework of job-rich growth which will create the jobs that we want in the medium and longer term. So we want to turn many more South Africans into victors over adversity and indeed deprivation, rather than be subject to welfare dependency over the longer term. Now, all this has got to come together. Once again, the hard-nosed approach will have to be revealed when we get to the medium-term budget policy statement. All this has to be brought together, because we are talking in isolation here about one or another part of a necessary agenda to deal with the next few months and to win back the investor confidence. Now, that means that by the time we get to October, which is not far away, we need to be able to send out a message that we are managing this situation in such a way that in the longer term, we are moving people out of welfare into work. And that's got to be the mantra which has to drive much of what we, of the renewal and the remedies and the reforms that we want to see in the near future.
Well, we do hope that we can achieve all of those objectives as we head into that mini budget in October. For now, I think a country badly in need of some good news and a bit of a boost would just be looking for a Springbok victory over the British and Irish Lions tomorrow. That was Raymond Parsons, who was joined around the table by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, and Isa Mklunga, Chief Economist at Alexander Forbes.